Accession number 3835, Reel 4.
Colonel Mundy, Reel 4. You were telling me that you sent this NCO to see your local doctor.
I sent him up to a friend of mine, the doctor. And he had a very good examination of him. At the end of 3 weeks, he said, he came back, he said, Patrick, I cannot find anything wrong with this man. But I realized that there is something mentally wrong. That's obvious. Well, I said, George, thank you very much. I don't know quite what to do. He said, well, I don't know. From a doctor's point of view, he is perfectly all right, but he's obviously not mental. And this went on, and eventually the fellow came to me, and he said, I'm sorry, I must go. He said, this man has got some witchcraft doctor onto him, and... as such, and he was not only mentally but physically, he was a wreck of a man. He was quite horrible. I marked him down to be my next regimental sergeant major, and I had to let him go. I was very sorry. Nothing I could do, and he agreed. He said he'd like to go because he said he was so miserable. He'd lost all his. His spirit and his enthusiasm and his control of the troops too, and that sort of thing, you see. He said he'd been bewitched, and I believed it. What you could do was beyond human organization, as far as I was concerned, or anybody else. The doctor said that I can't do anything for him. He's absolutely sound as a bell, physically, but not mentally. He said, I realize. And there it was, and I had to let him go. He reckoned he was bewitched.
Did you ever have any other cases like this?
No, except, again at Arusha, this was taken up by the government. A man appeared with a tumor. Somewhere right up at the back of his neck, close to the spinal cord, and that sort of game. You know, we've all got that. And the doctors looked at him, and they said, well, we can operate, but it's going to be risky. We can't guarantee a success because it's so close to the spinal cord, and there are arteries and all kinds of things up there. And so the fellow said, well, no, I'll go away. You see, well, perfectly... voluntary, I mean, there was no compulsion about it anyway, naturally. And so he went away. About a year later, he turned up again at Arusha. And by God, the tumor had been removed. And the doctors were so enthusiastic about it, they examined him and said yes. And it appeared, there was a photograph, there's a general report. Throughout of everything, education, KR, and doctors, and this was taken up by the doctors, and they photographed this bloke, and in the government report, which went to the colonial office, and I suppose the League of Nations, there was a picture of this man. The doctor's report was that whoever had done it was an exceedingly able performance. They couldn't quite make out what he'd done. The fellow said it was a little knife. We all thought it was a Gillette razor blade. Well, it was, we don't know. But the man who carried out the operation had no mean knowledge of anatomy. And he'd removed this tumor, and it was perfectly satisfied. The healing had been perfectly all right, the tumor had gone.
Did you have many European NCOs?
Did what?
Did you have many European NCOs?
In Tanganyika, no, just a regimental sergeant major. Then, as I explained, of course, we're coming to Uganda. We had I had the regimental sergeant major and two company sergeant majors and one European sergeant to each company, that's right, four, yeah, that's right, yeah. So we were, the head in Crete, and of course this educational, from the educational, Army Educational Corps, who came out solely to speak, to teach the Africans English, which then accepted, quite rightly. I think we all have done it before, but, well, there you are, it was finally approved that by the War House, I suppose, and aided by the Colonial Office, that education should include the speaking of English by the African. The chances were, of course, you'd get your African sergeant major and his sergeants and that sort of thing, to speak colloquial English after a bit. But of course, it's only just started a year before the war, 1938, I think they came out, and the fellows made some impact, but not a hell of a lot, of course, Thatcher wasn't the time.
Whilst you were in Tanganyika, was there much Africanization?
No, there was, it was really more, cotton on to the army, but of course to the on the civil side, yes, because this Africanization and encouraging the African to take an interest in his personal and public affairs was very much to the core, fostered of course originally by Sir Donald Cameron and Philip Mitchell, who was the chief secretary, who was keen on that, and the idea was eventually, of course, that they would take perhaps complete control, but looking forward to, well, the war turned up, so they had to rather stop. But the idea was for the African to become district officer, assistant district officer, and so forth, and eventually work up the scale. But I would say the difficulty of that the African mentality is rather different to ours, not so quick in the uptake and learning. He does learn, but it takes, where you and I would take perhaps, three or four months to appreciate something. Perhaps a little degradation, but it might take the African 3 or 4 years. You follow what I mean?
How long did you stay in Tanganyika?
30 to 35, about 5 years, yes.
And what happened when you came to the end of your term in Tanganyika?
I went back to my regiment, which was then stationed at Katerik. And I hadn't been there very long before we went out to Mussolini and the sanctions turned up. And we were sent off three battalions of the brigade. The Lincolns. Three of us went out, Lincolns and the, Scottish Rifles, no, Carisbys. And ourselves went out to Malta, a very sort of hush-hush affair, to reinforce the, and some gunners came out with us, and some RAF fellows came out with us. A whole boatload of us went out from Southampton. We were escorted by some naval cruiser or something from Gibraltar to Malta, I suppose, in case the town might put a hole in us, I don't know. But then the excitement was increasing the defences of Malta. We put up, it was very difficult because it's all rock. We had to learn how to, how these chaps on the road do with these. We had to get the stakes into the rock and put up the barbed wire. You had to blast holes in, like, you know, these fellows, you see them on the road. Well, that sort of thing, they gave us something. We had to learn how to use them in order to put the upright stakes in to put on the barbed wire around the coast. It's very difficult to land, of course, in Mallorca, because there are very few bays. However, that's all away from the KR. But there are a few sandy beaches, not many. And the idea was that we had a radar thing that looked towards Sicily, which they showed me. It was sort of rather embryo compared to what goes on today. But they did have that idea. The thing faced Sicily with a sort of broad, wide sheet, metal of sorts, something. And it would inform, because you see, Malta was only 20 minutes from Sicily. So if the Ites put a large shower in, it wasn't very long before they'd be there.
How was it that you ended up back in Africa again?
Oh, we went to Mussolini and co. died down, and then, of course, the thing shot up in Palestine. So there we were, you see. I told the chief administrator chap at Malta, I said, look here, you be prepared, we're going to be shut off to Palestine. Oh, he said, not a hope. But in a fortnight's time, the orders came, we all went on to Palestine. A fellow came in and said, could he do anything for me? I gave myself full marks. I said, I didn't say I told you so. And we went down, we were there 6 months, you see. We arrived about May or June, and the show didn't die down until Christmas. They sent the first division out from home, and that sort of fixed the show, and the Arabs gave in, and we all came home. And then we went to North Ireland, Londonderry, and then I got the offer there of the KR, 4th KR in Uganda.
How did this offer come to you?
Well, I mean, one day a letter came to the colonel's office offering me the command of the 4th KR, a lieutenant colonel, because I was only major then, you see. And so the pay is extremely good, and I would have probably got command in time. It'd been at least another year before I got command of my own battalion. So I took it, off I went. Got there it was just the time when Munich was on. Was it September 38, wasn't it? Yeah.
And you went out there as, what rank were you when you went out to Uganda?
Lieutenant Colonel.
What was your role as Lieutenant Colonel in Uganda?
Well, I was OC troops, and I had, I was OC troops, yes, but there was no other unit there except the 4th KR, which I commanded at that place, a very nice little station called Bombo, which is about 25 miles from Kampala. Had a cantonment there, very nice.
How did the troops there compare with the troops you'd commanded in Tanganyika?
I wouldn't say there's a very great deal of difference. The same sort of, you see, the Africans, and they were the same type of bloke as you met in Tanganyika. Yes. No, their attitude to this KR, to soldiering, and so forth, was very much the same as the attitude of the Tanganyika chaps to soldiering. No, very. I wouldn't say there are no difference.
Did you select men from specific tribes?
Mostly, yes. We had mostly Acholis and Langers from right up north. where it joins with the Sudan border, and from the West Nile, Kakras, and I can't remember the others, three tribes who were very good, and then we also had some Luos down on the Kenya border from by, what's the name of the port there? On Lake Victoria. Can't remember. Those were the major recruiting sources. Oh, and a certain, yes, and a certain amount of, from Barga, from Yugan, and they were known as Barganda. Yes, certain, yes, a certain amount from them. Those are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 main sources of recruitment. Because the Uganda unit had been, like mine, originally in the tank, only two companies. We now expanded to four companies.
Why was this? Why had you expanded to four companies?
Well, it was policy of the government. I think they saw the war was coming on to business.
Did this make any difference to conditions of service? The fact that, as you say, the government saw that a war was coming on?
You puzzle me on that, because I can't recollect. I think it was 5 or 6 years we enlisted them for. Well, honestly, I can't recollect. I ought to know, but I can't.
Was there any difference in training?
No.
Did you have any combined operations training in Uganda?
Nothing to go. Oh, it's with the RAF. Yeah, the RAF came up and did some operations with us in the bush in Uganda. Oh, yes, they came up. Yes.
Can you tell me something about those operations? What form did
they
take?
Well, what we did was, like Tanganyika, I went to a place. I found a place in the country. Oh, must have been west. Am I talking about west? West of, right out in the bush, west of Kampala and Entebbe. Right, took the troops out there for a whole lot, and then we got the RAF to come up. There was a landing ground, of course, in Entebbe. Even then, I mean, planes from England and so forth were coming there, and they landed there, and the RAF chap came along and gave us a lecture on operations with the RAF, and then we marched through the bush. As we went there, we went down by boat to a small port, and then marched about 30 miles to where this camp was. And from that camp back to Kampala, I went right through the bush. And the RAF came out, and I arranged that certain times they would be friendly, you see, and then another hour they'd be foe, so we had to hide from them. One time we sort of did the communications with them, and then another they went away and then came back again, and we tried to hide from them. It was just a sort of exercise. With the RAF, yes, they were quite good, yes.
How did the African troops react to these exercises with the RAF?
Well, they saw the flying thing. I don't think they knew that they could either shoot us or bomb us and that sort of thing, but don't think they really pictured the show as a menace, as it were. As well as whether the aeroplanes coming to Entebbe, and then they went on straight to Nairobi. So the African didn't really see very much, except he saw the planes sometimes in the air. I should say that their comprehension of the menace of the air was, slight, naturally, because they'd never seen, they saw the RAF planes, just like they saw the planes in the air, but we tried to picture what would happen and sort of thing, but I shouldn't think they really appreciated bombing or being fired at by machine guns from the air.
Did you you do any combined operations training with the Navy?
Not in Uganda. It's about 600 or 700 miles from the sea.
Had you done some in Tanganyika then?
Oh, yes, we did. Oh, yes, the Navy used to come into Dar es Salaam once a year, usually. A cruiser, sometime an escorting vessel, and the Admiral used to come and have a conference with the governor. And I was to put the troops on board arrangements of the captain of the ship. We put about 100 troops on board, and then sailed up the course for about 40 or 50 miles and represented ourselves as a raiding party going into the bush and destroying a telegraph station or something like that, and then re-embarking on the Navy and backing back into Dar es Salaam. It was quite good fun. Yes, yes, we did that.
How did the African troops respond to being on board ship?
Oh, all right. Yes, all right. Oh, yes, of course, we had our officers with them explaining it and that sort of thing. Of course, they were taken round the ship, and the guns and the compass and things were rather beyond. What they really appreciated was you went into a cabin, you turned on hot water or cold water. That they thought was marvellous. Well, of course, it wouldn't to them. Guns and compass and things like that, just a bit beyond their ken.
To go back to Uganda, did the fact that the Italians were in Abyssinia have any effect on the types of training you gave the troops?
No. Except if in case of war we knew we'd meet Italians, which we did. And we understood we'd got the better of them, which we did.
Did you have any instructions about how to deal with the Italians on the border?
No.
Were your troops trained to meet European troops in combat? Or were they just given the normal bush training?
No, I were the only. From what we knew of the Italians, and the Italian troops we were likely to meet were very much the same, on the same lines as the KR, officered by Italian officers, but actually African or Ethiopian troops. In the battle, I think there were a certain amount of Italian officers and a certain amount of Italian NCOs. I think the others were mainly African. I can't remember now.
Were they given any anti-tank training at all?
No. No, we hadn't got any we had no anti-tank rifles or anything like that.
What sort of, bearing in mind that, as you said before, the government were expanding the forces with war in mind, was the equipment any better for your troops?
Vickers guns.
You had?
Vickers guns. And of course, we had some artillery some batteries came out from England. So, I mean, in our battle at Sarajevo, South African the squadron, I think, to help me, and also we had a battery of artillery.
Did you have any trouble on the border with Abyssinia?
Not before the war, no.
What was the deployment of the regiment in Uganda? Where were the various units deployed?
Well, the KR were concentrated at this place, Bombo. But we had a company at Lokitang, which is up on the Kenya border with Abyssinia.
And what were your... Did you go and visit these stations?
Oh, yes. Yes, I went up to Lokitanga. Very rather... a bit up in the air. It was very hot and very dry. Where the main reason, really, for Lokitanga was there was water there, because water's very scarce in those... all around Lake Rudolph. And you can't drink Lake Rudolph because it's so salt. Well, there's one local tribe... What are they called now? Just the Toten Yang, Wanderobo, I think the name was. They drank the water, but they were rather a miserable tribe. And well, I suppose in extremis you would have drunk it, but only that. We had this little platoon post that we had forward towards the Abyssinian border from Lokitang. We had to send lorries down with fresh water twice a week. For them to drink and cook.
And what sort of unit would be stationed out here at these outposts?
Well, just as one company at Lokitang with a forward platoon at Toten Yang, which is about 20 miles towards the Ethiopian border.
Was the training that the troops received similar to that at Tanganyika?
Yes, yes.
Can you think of any ways in which it differed?
We had this cooperation with the RAF, but no.
What were the functions of the KAR in Uganda at this time?
Well, it was just a unit in this place, Bombo, with the four of the... And once a year, it didn't occur, we used to go up to the Sudan border and cooperate with the Sudan Defense Force, because there's a certain amount of local raiding by the locals. I used to go and birch up the local people and seize their women and that sort of thing. And that was going to come into force, only the war broke out instead. But that was it was cooperation between the Sudan Defense Force and ourselves. It was a mountain now, I reckon, called Piri. It was known as the Piri Patrol. I was going to take two companies up or something like that. And meet the Sudan Defense Force because the borderline was up there, and I suppose have a little cooperation with them and see if there are any local tribes making a nuisance themselves, and which they did, and they used to raid and cattle and women and